Welcome to the 29th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to New York City for a State of the Science Summit on advanced non-small cell lung cancer. The meeting, which featured insight from experts from NYU Langone's Perlmutter Cancer Center, covered a wide array of topics, ranging from surgical techniques to headway made in immunotherapy to emerging biomarkers to diagnostic advancements. Progress made with immunotherapy and targeted therapy has changed the way researchers view lung cancer, but the role of surgery remains firm, said Robert J. Serfolio, MD, Chief of Thoracic Surgery at NYU Langone's Perlmutter Cancer Center. The use of robotic surgical systems and video-assisted procedures has improved how surgeons can visualize the operating site. These new tools are also associated with less pain, a shorter hospital stay, and a quicker return to daily activities. At the meeting, we sat down with Serfolio, who highlighted how these surgical advances have dramatically changed post-operative quality of life.
So just because you could do something better doesn't mean you should change the indication when you have to do it. And I think that was maybe true 10 years ago. I don't think it's true now. Let's hope not. No, the indication for surgery remains the same. In fact, our benign resection rate has gone way down. We're probably at 5% now. It used to be about 10 to 12. So no, I think we're even being more selective with surgery because we're able to diagnose these things minimally invasively even better now rather than having to whack people in the OR. Listen, man, it is completely different, totally different. When I trained, we were doing thoracotomies this big, cutting one muscle at least, sometimes two, usually one, putting great big steel retractors in, spreading the ribs. And I did 10,000 or 9,000 of those. Now, I haven't done one of those in almost 3 years, 4 years, because we're so good with little incisions in either the robot or a thing called VATS. I do mostly robotic operations, although today I did a VATS. But, you know, that's video-assisted thoracoscopy or robotic. The point is tiny little incisions. With the robot, the incisions are a third of an inch, a fourth of an inch. It's incredible. No muscles cut. They spend one night in the hospital. I've had a few people go home the same day of a lobectomy. They get no Foley catheter. They're back at work sometimes in a week. I've had a few surgeons go back at work in a week. I've had a few athletes go back 10 days. It's unbelievable. Completely different ball game. The risks went from 1%. We haven't had a death in a lobectomy in almost 1,000 patients to less than 0.1%. The pain has gone from agony for really 6 to 8 weeks to 3 months to you're still taking a narcotic at 4 days? What's the matter with you? Really? Be careful lifting the gym your 5 days after surgery. It's a completely different world. There's a surgeon, a well-known surgeon I did at a big famous cancer center down in the mid-south part of the United States, was back operating post-op day 6. I did a lobectomy on him and he was back doing surgery in 6 days. It's just unbelievable.
Although tissue biopsies are still a diagnostic gold standard in solid tumors, recent data have suggested a potential advantage with liquid biopsies. Not only are liquid biopsies minimally invasive, said Joshua K. Sabari, MD, but they may also provide a clearer picture of a patient's disease history and molecular markup. In our interview, Sabari, an assistant professor of medicine at NYU Langone's Perlmutter Cancer Center, weighed the pros and cons of liquid biopsies and explain how they can eventually be integrated into routine clinical practice.
Liquid biopsy is a novel mechanism to identify circulating tumor DNA in the peripheral blood. And by doing that, we're able to identify genetic alterations that we're then able to match patients to targeted therapies. Tumors are heterogeneous, so a metastatic lesion in the lung versus a metastatic lesion in the liver might have different genetic compositions. And by testing plasma or blood, we're able to identify what alterations may be circulating in the body. So tissue still remains the standard of care, as we need to define histology But I think liquid biopsy is more accessible. It's easier to do. The turnaround time is a lot quicker. Most of our liquid biopsy assays are able to turn around in 7 to 10 days, whereas tissue next generation sequencing takes about 3 weeks on average. We did an interesting study where we compared the actual correlation or concordance between tissue NGS and plasma NGS, and we did find that if you identified an alteration in the plasma, it was identified in the tissue about 96-97% of the time. However, the beauty of plasma next generation sequencing for liquid biopsy was the turnaround time had an average of 9 days, whereas the turnaround time for tissue had an average of about 21 days. So I think getting patients the results that they need to get matched to targeted therapy quicker is better for their sort of overall outcome. So I think liquid biopsies are critical in patients who you have a high pretest probability of having a genetic driver alteration. So specifically younger patients, patients who are never smokers, and these are patients who, you know, you do standard immunohistochemistry for EGFR and ALK and are negative, I think liquid biopsy is extremely helpful and to identify other alterations such as ROS1, BRAF for example, or also non-FDA approved indications for alterations like RET rearrangements, MET exon 14 skipping alterations, as well as HER2 alterations, both mutations and amplifications.
Sabari also took the time to highlight emerging immunotherapy combinations in the space. 2018 was a big year for immunotherapy in lung cancer. This form of treatment is now the frontline standard of care for metastatic disease, both as a single agent and in combination across squamous and non-squamous histologies. Specifically, Sabari discussed results from the PACIFIC trial, which looked at the use of durvalumab following concurrent chemoradiotherapy in stage 3 unresectable disease, which demonstrated a survival advantage with the addition of the checkpoint inhibitor.
So what I'll talk about tonight is immune therapy combinations, and really what I'll focus on in the early stage setting is the PACIFIC trial, which looked at durvalumab after patients received concurrent chemotherapy and radiation. And the results of that study were groundbreaking, leading to the FDA approval and the new indication for that regimen. So a 12-month overall survival benefit for people who've gotten durvalumab consolidation therapy after chemotherapy and radiation. And then I'll move into the late stage or stage 4 disease, where I'll talk about two very important studies that were recently presented, the KEYNOTE-189, which is a combination of pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone. And I'll also talk about the IMpower 150 regimen, which is a quadruplet regimen similar to what we had mentioned in the KEYNOTE-189, but using atezolizumab in combination with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab versus the carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab alone. You know, there's definitely synergy between the drugs. For example, we have an objective response rate of chemo, we have an objective response rate of immunotherapy, and you know, by combining drugs that work, you may get a better response rate, better duration of response, and also better overall survival. But I think there's more to that and there's more science there. I think what, you know, specific chemotherapeutics are doing are improving the sort of immune response to recognize and attack the cancers.
Next, we sat down with Elaine Shum, MD, an assistant professor of medicine at NYU Langone's Perlmutter Cancer Center. In our interview, she highlighted the rapidly evolving and complex field of frontline therapy for oncogene-driven non-small cell lung cancer, specifically options for patients with EGFR and ALK abnormalities.
Well, the data from FLAURA was very impressive, and you know, as we all know, it's already been approved, you know, to be used in the frontline setting, and you know, we're definitely using this already in practice. Just some of the things we still don't have, you know, overall survival data. I think we all do expect that we will be seeing an overall survival benefit. Of course, we hope, but the median progression-free survival, you know, was already very impressive, and so even if we, you know, unless the overall survival data, you know, comes back very surprising, you know, I don't think that it's going to really change, you know, what we're doing in terms of what we already know about FLAURA. Definitely the effect on CNS penetration of osimertinib used in these patients is, you know, something that really takes it beyond, you know, some of the other EGFR TKIs that we've been using for so long. Yes, so based on the ALEX trial, I definitely think that alectinib should be the first-line drug that we go towards. This past year's World Lung, you know, some of the interim data from the ALTA-1L or for the brigatinib trial, you know, came out, you know, to also use brigatinib in the frontline setting. Of course, we don't have a comparison between alectinib and brigatinib, and some of the data is still a bit early from brigatinib, so we'll have to see how things go as more data comes out. For now, just because the data is so striking from alectinib, you know, that's still going to be my preferred first choice.
In her presentation at the State of the Science Summit, Shum also shed light on emerging biomarkers in this space. Because we now have effective therapies, even for patients with rare mutations, she also discussed the importance of next-generation sequencing in today's landscape.
So my talk on emerging biomarkers are going to be highlighting some of the much less common, but they are still out there, oncogenic drivers such as RET, MET in terms of MET exon 14 skipping mutations, as well as MET amplifications. I'll also be talking about tumor mutation burden, or TMB, is using that as somewhat of a biomarker in terms of whether immunotherapy combinations should be used. And, you know, I think these are all emerging, but they're emerging very quickly, and that means we're already having drug approvals for a lot of these drivers already, and so just want everyone to be aware about them. So some of the rare, well, depends on what you define as rare, but, you know, a lot of these oncogenic drivers, you know, even though it's only 1 or 2% of all non-small cell lung cancers that have them, you know, this can still make a difference for your patient. So, I mean, they're all going to be particular towards, you know, the target that they have, but the fact that we do have drugs out there that can target them, you know, is important and something to remember as we find them.
Lastly, we were joined by the chair of the meeting, Kwok Kin Wong, MD, PhD, the Chief of Medical Oncology at NYU Langone's Perlmutter Cancer Center. He echoed his colleague's sentiments regarding how far research has come in lung cancer, but, he stressed, there's still a long way to go. In our interview, Wong discussed the heterogeneity of lung cancer and underscored the importance of clinical trials.
As you know, non-small cell lung cancer is a very heterogeneous disease. We can divide it into cancers that has no oncogenic drivers and cancers in which there are no oncogenic drivers. And there's been incredible advances made on both sides. For the patients whose lung cancer has oncogenic drivers, we're developing more and more new drugs, and more of those drugs are getting FDA approval. For the ones that don't have no oncogenic drivers or whose oncogenic drivers don't have targeted therapeutics, I think immunotherapy has done an incredible impact on the treatment of these patients. We're extending the survival of these patients by months, if not years. And this is actually an incredible, amazing time to think about what combination of drugs we can put together to even increase the number of patients that respond to either targeted therapy or immunotherapy. As you know, immunotherapy had came into the forefront of the treatment of lung cancer patients. Something I never thought would happen in my lifetime, we're actually seeing in a very small subset of patients with advanced lung cancer, we're actually seeing cures, or patients that have responses that are durable for 5, 6, 7 years. And when you start going that far out, you start thinking about cure. Unfortunately, you know, that's a very small subset. And I think there's a lot of really interesting clinical trials that's going on now to try to extend the duration of response for the greater majority of patients whose benefit is only measured about 12 to 18 months for most for treatments with immunotherapy. I think when a patient has exhausted all standard of care treatment that's been approved by FDA, those patients actually would benefit quite a bit into going to clinical trials. Obviously for the patient as well as for all other patients that have lung cancer. Clinical trials are the only way we can objectively measure how a novel drug that's not been approved by the FDA, whether they actually work better than the standard of care. And this is also a time where we can actually learn quite a bit about the patient's cancer, as well as the biology behind the patient's cancer with these clinical trials. The clinical trials have now become so sophisticated that we can learn quite a bit about that particular patient's disease and extend that knowledge to other patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 29th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to hear more about the treatment landscape of lung cancer, consider registering for the March 6th State of the Science Summit in Orlando, Florida. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on March 12th in Miami, which will focus on advances made in hematologic malignancies. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.